very much. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for the opportunity and to talk here today in this nice program. So I'm going to devote this talk to show you some of the applications of Lattice QCD for studying multi-hadron systems. So there's been quite a lot of good progress in this direction in recent years, both in terms of understanding the formalism that is required to connect these calculations to the physical observables of interest, and in terms of the numerical and algorithmic advances that had required these calculations to be performed. Unfortunately, I wouldn't be talking about these numerical advances here. Mostly I'm going to focus on the formalism side, but I'm going to present the talk in a way that it's also focused on the physics result that has been accomplished based on understanding this formalism mostly. Also, I'm going to warn you that today I'm using a new software for presentation. This is my first time, so hopefully you don't get frustrated with this new presentation slide, and nothing goes wrong, so we will see. Okay. So before starting, I'm going to just showcase some of the results that would show you the state-of-the-art calculations with regard to multi-hadron systems. So this is, for example, a calculation by MPI-QCD collaborations, two of the members being here in the audience, Martin and Will. And this is showing how we can start from QCD degrees of freedom, quark and gluons, put the QCD interactions in, and get nuclear physics. Basically, this plot shows the binding energies of light nuclei and also hypernuclei, and the two-body system, three-body system, and four-body systems, as you can see in this plot, at a slightly a heavy quantum mass, but this actually tells you that basically the technology is there to, with the available computational resources in upcoming years, one can reach the physical points and start actually studying nuclear physics from the underlying theory of QCD. There's been other efforts in this direction by various other collaborations, mostly based in Japan. If you're interested, you can look up these references. But also, I decided to show you another example, again by MPI-QCD, in studying quarkonium nuclei from Lattice QCD, and that's why the reason is that we had this nice talk last week with Marina about these above-threshold pentaquark states that are resonances in proton J-psi channel. You can see that Lattice QCD calculations can actually tell you that there are below-threshold systems that are bound, basically, in the two-body, three-body, and four-body nucleons bound to, for example, charmonium system or a strange quarkonium system, which is quite a nice result. And in fact, there has been theoretical speculations that these systems should exist at the physical point. There has been experimental searches. There hasn't been any discovery, but this is already telling you that Lattice QCD could be a way to study these systems even at the physical point. The plot that is in the lower panel shows these binding energies as a function of the atomic number of the parent nucleus, showing some sort of saturation, which would be a nice feature. So you can see that there are quite exotic multi-hadron systems that you can study using Lattice QCD techniques. So these calculations are actually happening. And but in order to understand the physics, we need to first identify the observables and then see what on the Lattice QCD side, what can be calculated and how this calculation can be related to those observables. So I've decided to divide my talk to several sections. Each section would correspond to a different set of observables, similar observables, the formalism required to understand them, and then some Lattice QCD, recent Lattice QCD result that has been using this formalism to get to physics. So the simplest system you can think beyond the single particle states are elastic processes in two hadron states. So the problem is that if you start putting two hadrons, which each is composed of QCD degrees of freedom, and these are interacting via some hadronic interactions that are coming from the underlying QCD interactions. What would be the scattering observables? What would be the elastic scattering parameters of the system? And for example, the hadronic forces that we can presumably parameterize in a low energy effective field theory, how can you constrain those force parameters by studying this system on lattice? So it might seem straightforward to start from the system in lattice QCD and get this view by the observables. However, there is a no-go theorem by Maione and Testa saying that Euclidean correlation functions of infinite volume cannot be related to the scattering amplitude of the Minkowski space in infinite volume, except at kinematic threshold, which is obviously not the range of energies we are necessarily interested in. So what do we do? So the solution to this problem is well known. It's due to Luscher. I'm going to first sketch again what the problem is that we want to consider in this talk. So in the two-hadron system, you start from some correlation functions of two interpolators that create and annihilate a two-hadron systems. And you get some energy levels. This calculation is in a finite volume, discretized Euclidean spacetime, right? And then imagine that you take the continuum limit of the correlators, but you're still having this problem in a finite volume in Euclidean correlators. The question is how you relate this calculation to the scattering parameters of the infinite volume theory in Minkowski space. In order to understand the differences between this infinite volume and finite volume, it's good to look at the kinematic of the problem. It is well known that the scattering amplitude in the two hadron states in the energy plane has this analytic structure. It has a cut corresponding to continuum scattering states starting at the threshold of this system, and presumably some bounded state if the system and the forces allow you to have a bounded state. You have these isolated poles at the negative values of real energies. What happens in the finite volume is that this cut is actually replaced by a set of discrete poles. For example, for non-interacting case, they are separated by of the order of 1 over m, the mass of the particle, times L squared, L being the specialized extent of the volume. And then you have also the poles on the real negative energy axis that are away from the poles in the infinite volume. So one other question is that how you identify those corrections to the bounded state pole, and then how you can relate this set of poles to this cut and in general to the constraining the analogous structure of the infinite volume scattering amplitude. So here is an example of the type of quantities that we actually calculate in lattice QCD calculations. So if you're interested in 2 pi and the scattering, then what you do is to form correlation functions for different values of volumes. So this is a calculation that by a group of physicists at JLab studying this pi-pi scattering. And what they evaluate are these set of energy eigenvalues in a volume. So that's what comes out of correlation functions. And then comparing with this non-interacting band. So these curves are the energy dependence of non-interacting 2 pi in the states. So you can see that these points are actually shifted from these nearby non-interacting energies. And that's already telling you that this is due to interactions. And these interactions are the ones that are responsible for infinite volume physics, right? So we can use these energies for these energy shifts to constrain interactions on the scattering amplitude, and that's the whole idea of the Luscher mechanism. So the original work is due to Martin Luscher more than 20 years ago. He gave very nice derivations in both quantum mechanics and quantum field theory for this idea. There's been a lot of generalizations of the method for systems that have arbitrary momentum, spin, arbitrary twisted boundary conditions, coupled channel, etc. that I've listed here. So if you're interested, you can check out these references. Probably I've missed some references, so this is not an inclusive list, but hopefully this helps you if you want to start to get some idea about this formalism. For today's talk, I'm not going to give you too much detail of the technicalities of these derivations. I'm just going to sketch some of the basics of the derivations based on a field theory approach at the hadronic level, so we can think about the correlation functions of the finite volume. So this is the quantity that you actually calculate on the lattice when the continuum limit is taken. Also, for this derivations, we assume that the time extent is large enough that you can take it to be infinite. And then you are only dealing with a special box. The other assumption here is that you're below the three particle production thresholds. So this is just a scattering of 2 to 2, and any particle that is produced in this intermediate states would correspond to some off-shell states. These are going to be exponential corrections in volume to this formalism that I'm going to present. And for the time being, we just ignore them. You're interested in more severe corrections, which are power law due to unshell states. Okay, so what you do, you start with these correlation functions, and you think about two hadrons that are created and annihilated by these two sigma sigma primes, or some sort of interpolating operators for two hadron states. And then what happens, they can propagate from the source to sink. They can propagate via interacting via this strong interaction kernel. And then you can have multiple of these. This is a strongly interacting system, so it's a non-perturbative problem. So you have this chain of interactions, and then the question is that how can you relate this quantity, this chain of interactions, to infinite volume quantities, which in this case is an on-shell scattering amplitude. And the way it works, it's actually quite simple. So you have these loops, two particle propagators, that you can, so this is actually summing over all momentum modes in this loop, because this is an infinite, this is a finite volume calculations, the momentum modes are discretized, and you can actually replace this with a finite, infinite volume piece, plus a purely finite volume corrections with a quaternary summation formula. But that's just details, but you can have this replacement. And if you do this replacement in each of these loops here, and you identify any structure of this type when you have a strongly interacting kernel propagating via this finite infinite volume loops, then you can say that's a scattering amplitude. The other nice thing is that when you actually do the separations, the piece that is remaining in this finite volume loops are actually evaluated on shell. And the reason is that the large volume corrections are coming from the points in the propagator where you have singularities. When your sum end is singular, and that's corresponding to two particle state going on shell. So this is going to be power law corrections. And that means that anything that is attached to these loops, including this A and A prime coming from this sigma sigma prime, plus this scattering amplitude is evaluated on shell, and this is the quantity that you're interested in. All right, now that you have this expansion of the correlation function in terms of the scattering amplitude, you can, it's just a geometric sum. You basically sort of separated out these loops, and then you can do a geometric sum, basically, of this. And then by looking at the poles of this expression, you can identify the energy eigenvalues of the volume. So the poles of the correlation functions are the eigenvalues in a finite volume. And then what ends up being, it's just this simple-looking relation. It's a determinant condition of a function delta GV, which is a finite volume function, includes every kinematics and the information about the kinematics and also the geometry of the lattice in it. And then you have the inverse scattering amplitude evaluated on shell. And these on shell values are actually the energy eigenvalues that you calculate on the lattice calculations. So this is a nice relation. So this is a scattering amplitude. This is diagonal in the J basis because you have rotational symmetry in the infinite volume. However, this delta GV depends on the geometry of your calculations. For a cubic calculation, then you break rotational invariance, you have just cubic symmetry, so you can mix different angular momentum channels. So that's a feature of this. So this is the master equation. So what do you do with it? You have to know the form of delta GV. It's not that important. I'm just going to show you what the form of this function is for two nucleons for an arbitrary spin, isospin, and other all these quantum numbers. And it looks like something like this, some collection of Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. Don't have to take anything from this. I'm just saying that the only function that depends on the geometry of the lattice are these C functions related to the Luscher Z functions. So for example, if you have twisted boundary conditions, then that comes in inside this C, which is a sum over momentum modes in a way that would respect the symmetries of the finite volume calculations. So what you have to do is to grab these matrix or these determinant conditions and then block diagonalize this full matrix, make some truncations, and identify those blocks that correspond to a given symmetry of the calculation. So that's just details. Don't have to worry about it. Just because there was a mention of anti-periodic boundary conditions today, I thought I would show this plot, which is obviously showing that if you turn the periodic boundary conditions to an anti-periodic boundary condition, so you can change the kinematics. So this is a two-nucleon system in the deuteron channel. So this is the binding energy of the deuteron, which is this. But you can see if you turn this to anti-periodic boundary conditions, the system is not even bound. So we can change the kinematics, but we know how to handle this. We have the formalism. It's all inside the C functions. So we can look at this these papers, for example.
Everything in that final box is geometry.
Yes. Yes. Geometry, the kinematics. So it's evaluated. So K star is the unshelled value of energy. But everything else, so you can have a total momentum for the system that would change the final volume corrections that you get. You can change the twisted boundary condition. You can give different masses to the particles that are scattering. So all that is incorporated in this function. So obviously, I'm not showing the explicit form of that function, but you can look up the papers. It's now well known how to deal with this. And now, with these master equations, what do you do? So you go and look at different systems of interest if you want to study hadronic interactions or scattering amplitudes, you can go ahead and use this Luscher methodology, do the lattice calculations, and get these energy levels, put inside that formula, and then do some physics. So I've just decided to show several examples. I'm going to just go quickly over these just to demonstrate the range of applications.
I wanted to slow you down a little bit. Can you go back to the formula?
Okay.
So that level is fine.
Okay.
This is for the go back to the simple formula for the term.
Okay.
So the delta G that mm-hmm. has actually geometry information and dynamics.
No, there's not. What do you mean by dynamics? It depends on the energy.
Calculation of energy levels.
So yes, it depends on the energy that is evaluated. So this delta GV is calculated at the center of mass energies. Which are discretized, so we grab these values from the energy levels that we get. Right. So you do a calculation, you get a set of energy levels from your lattice calculations, and equal 1, 2, some excited states, so on for a given volume, right? So this would be a function of En and L. With that, so that function you know the form of, and then you have M inverse evaluated at the same energy, right? And then this is a matrix in general because you could have different angular momentums. And then by solving this equation, so you can parameterize this scattering amplitude in terms of if this is a single channel, you have a phase shift, right? So the phase shift would be an energy dependent phase shift. And then for that given energy eigenvalue and that given volume, we can solve this equation and get the phase shift at that particular energy. And then you just map out the phase shifts for different, so that's why you need different levels, presumably different volumes, and so on, to get different energies, so you can map out the phase shift as a function of energy. So this is the procedure. Okay.
So in the old textbook of the S matrix people, they like to take poles and make them go on the second sheet.
Right.
Is so, something?
Yes, I'm going to show you actually an example of that, a more complicated application of this in coupled channels. So you would see that, yes, you can constrain all those sort of poles on an atomic structure of escaping amplitude by mapping out these phase shifts. So that's going to be in another section, but we'll get there soon. Okay, so. Okay, so the first example I'm going to show you is for two nucleon systems. So this is of interest to nuclear physicists, but I guess any curious physicist, that what happens to nuclear physics if you change the pion masses. Another nice question you can ask is nuclear physics truly finely tuned in a sense that, for example, you know that there is a shallow bound state, the deuteron, which is very shallow. It's quite unnatural. Given the scale of the system, is this a generic feature of QCD, or is it because of the parameters of QCD, the pion masses being finely tuned to give you this quasi object? So one investigation based on this has been done by, again, MPL QCD collaborations a while back. And you can see that one way to test this is to do calculations of different pion masses. Use the Lucher formula to constrain a scattering length, A, and effective range. And this ratio would give you a measure of the naturalness in the system. So if the ratio is large, that means that there is another scale in the problem, which is not of the order of the scale of the interactions. That's going to be unnatural. For example, this is about 3 at the physical point, so it's big. And when you perform the calculation at 800 MeV, it's about 2. So it seems like the system is still unnatural. And you can also look at the binding momentum of the system as a function of pion mass. And this isn't, again, this is falling down. This is another feature that is saying that presumably, because this is a wide range of pion masses, you still see some unnaturalness in the system. So it doesn't seem quite finely tuned. It is speculated that this is presumably a property of QCD and three colors as opposed to the values of the parameters. If you look at the other S equals zero, spin equals zero channel of two nucleon system, you can see quite a large variations for this quantity. So the system seems to be slightly more finely tuned in this case than the deuteron channel, but it's still unnatural. So one interesting feature is that, so this is a dineutron system, and this is performed at, for example, 800 MeV. At 800 MeV, the dineutron is bound, but it's not being it's not bound, as we know, at the physical point. So the world could be quite different at these heavy pion masses. And using this two-particle methodology would help you to investigate this kind of curious questions about nature. The other example is studying hypernucleon interactions. So despite the nucleon-nucleon interactions, where experimental values are very well known, little is known about hypernucleon interactions from experiment. And these are particularly interesting if you want to know the composition of dense nuclear matter. For example, at the densities that are relevant to neutron stars, what would be the relevant degrees of freedom at the hadronic level? This requires understanding what these hypernucleon interactions are. Again, NPIQCD has done this explorations of the hypernucleon interactions in N sigma minus channel. So again, there are two different spin channels, and you can map out the phase shifts at different values of pion mass. I think this is done only for one 400 MeV pion mass. And then you can actually use an effective field theory to constrain the corresponding force parameters in the effective field theory and extrapolate to the physical point. And then you can check against the models, phenomenological models, or effective field theory calculations. So you can see, so there is a large error bars for lattice calculations, but that already tells you that putting more resources into this, you're in the road to get more precise predictions for such unknown systems. Then you can say useful things about the role of, for example, strangeness and hyperons in, for example, the equation of the states of these dense nuclear matters. It would be a very interesting question to answer from the nuclear astrophysics point of view. Another example that has been, so several collaborations have been investing in doing this calculation. One of the few two hadron scattering calculations that have been done is pi-pi scattering in the I equal two channels. This is a plot that's showing the results of various different calculations that has done, and this is compared to the chiral perturbation theory expectations. This is, in a sense, a way to test chiral perturbation theory expectations. But also, if you look at the numbers, you can see that lattice QCD, even in these two-hadron systems, is giving rise to more precise determinations compared to the experimental value. So this is quite.
So the bottom half is the stuff that Norman was mentioning that isn't actually from pion collisions, but from pi p collisions, and quite a bit of your analysis.
Yes. So yeah. So.
And I guess the lattice calculations, as you go down, mm-hmm. is increasing time. So.
This one?
No. On the right hand.
Uh huh.
I guess the top with the huge error bar is a pioneering work, and then they become more refined and have more resources.
Yes, I don't know if this is chronological, but probably you're right. Yes. Okay, so this is as you see, you can study hadronic interactions by lattice QCD. When you do so, you can actually think about hadronic resonances as well. So as we all know, QCD has this exotic spectrum, and this is being this is going to be explored in various experiments, including the GLUX at JLab, but also as we heard last week, you can encounter these exotic states of QCD in these experiments too. So it's nice if we can actually constrain or shed light on the nature of these resonances and exotic states from the perspective of underlying QCD interactions. So this is the program that, for example, JLab physicists have been pursuing. And in order to understand the importance of doing rigorous calculations in these channels and how, in fact, complex this kind of analysis could be, let me show you an example of a spectrum that, again, a group of people at JLab has been producing. So this is quite impressive level of precision, given that these are highly excited states in different with different quantum numbers. And you can see they have a very good identification of spin quantum numbers, which is kind of non-trivial if you think about cubic symmetry of the calculations, and also this precision for these higher excited states. But are these corresponding to the infinite volume exotic states of the QCD? Is this the spectrum of QCD? Well, it is the spectrum of QCD, but it's a spectrum of QCD in a finite volume and in Euclidean spacetime. And you have to make sure to correctly relate that to the physical spectrum. And one way to understand this is that only a few stable particles are below the inelastic two-particle thresholds. For example, in this case, you can see that. So this is a heavier pion mass. So the pi-pi threshold is like here. And then you can start having enough energy to open these multi-particle channels. And the reason that's important is that most of these states are at the physical point, these are resonances. And in order to get the decay width and the mass of these resonances, for example, you have to study coupled multiparticle scattering amplitude for these systems and look at the analogous structure of these scattering amplitudes and then say something about the resonance feature of these scattering amplitudes. So this is quite a daunting task. If you think about these multiple channels that have to be considered in the analysis. So what's the simplest resonance you can think of to start building some confidence that you can actually deal with this system in lattice QCD? So that's, for example, the raw resonance, which is a resonance in the pi-pi channel in the L equal 1. So this is a p-wave scattering in the pi-pi channel. And what you do, as I said, you grab the Lucier formula, you extract all different energy levels that you can, so plenty of energy levels, and then you map out the phase shift. And what you end up with, each of these points would correspond to those energy levels that you've acquired in the lattice calculations. You start putting this phase shift in, and you can see, so these are for heavier point masses. As you can see, you can start seeing the Breit-Wigner shape type behavior of the phase shifts, telling you that there is a resonance in this channel, and then you can do some using some parameterization of a scattering amplitude to fit to this data, and then analytically continue to complex values of energy. Basically, if you know that parameterization and can constrain that, then you can say what the properties of the corresponding resonances are. So, for example, I'm showing two different point masses. One is slightly higher. So you see that this is a higher point mass. And you can see that this is quite a narrow resonance compared to this a smaller point mass. As you go toward the physical point, the resonance become broader, and this is one feature that you couldn't tell if you didn't do the calculation. So this is quite nice and impressive.
Sorry, very naive question. Yeah. How do you get the points so close together? Do you vary the volume or?
They don't have many different volumes, but the way to get them is to give different momentum to the particles and put them in different irreducible representations. So you need different kinematic points at the same volume. The way to do it is to introduce different total momentum to the system. If you do so, it would change the geometry of the lattice. So that means that the energy eigenvalues are going to be different. So that's the way to get multiple. And in order to get excited states, so they use this variational method, they diagonalize and get the clean extractions of menu. So they put in a lot of different interpolators. So they can get a lot of excited states very cleanly as well. Okay, so one question is that now that you have these resonances, can you, without doing the physical point calculations, can you extrapolate to the physical point? So at the physical point, if you wanted to do these calculations, because the pions are light, then this multi-particle threshold are actually within the energy range that you have to worry about them. Because as I said, this formalism only considers the two particle states. So if you have intermediate four particles, six particles, and so on, then you're in trouble. You have to put them in the formalism and then try to constrain the whole scattering amplitude, the coupled channel scattering amplitude. At those unphysical masses, you don't have to worry about them much. At the physical point, you do, but as is shown in this paper, you can use a modified version of chiral perturbation theory, namely the unitarized chiral perturbation theory, to constrain the parameters of the chi-pt, unitarized chi-pt, and then make an extrapolation to the physical point, and then if you compare it with the experimental value, you see an impressive agreement.
Can you say a few words about what unitarized chiral perturbation?
So with chiral perturbation theory, because it's perturbation theory, you cannot extract resonances, right? These are non-perturbative objects. But one way that has been shown that can actually quite work well for the raw resonance is that instead of, so for S-channel type diagrams, when the pions are scattering off in the S-channel, then you sum up all these S-channel diagrams to all orders. But you would treat the T-channel and U-channel diagrams perturbatively. So I don't exactly know what the physical ground for this is, The only thing is that we observe that then if you look at the analogous structure of this object, you can actually reproduce the physical, the experimental values very well. So it's kind of maybe surprising. You might not be able to do that for many other systems of interest. The draw might be special in that regard, but.
So these are some of the same objects as before.
Yes, two of them.
This is 140 MeV.
Yeah, so this is an extrapolation to the 140. So they're using, yes. So they're using these two pion masses, 400 and 236. And they constrain the unitarized chiral perturbation theory, and then they extrapolate to the physical point. We have experimental data on the physical point, and it seems to agree very well. But the question is, can you do that for other system, a whole other range of exotics that you're interested in? That's an open question, but this is certainly a nice analysis.
They sketched all these additional thresholds, which were somehow.
It seems like
one level that they're omitted, but I guess the 4 and the 6 prior are supposed to be coming in through the resummation that you mentioned.
The thing is that when you do the calculation at these on physical pion masses, you don't have to worry about them. So you get these phase shifts without having to worry about those channels. You can constrain unitarized perturbation theory with these values of phase shifts. And then you extrapolate to the physical point without worrying about those, because you've already constrained the theory at a range that you didn't have to worry about those. So it's kind of nice that it works.
So if we were happy with the UCI PT and understood it thoroughly, would this tell us that the 4 pi, 6 pi,
yes, there is
8 pi are not very important?
Exactly. There is. That means that the coupling to these multiparticle states is quite small. That's what it's telling you, right, at a physical point. But whether you can say that about other systems, we don't know. We have to do the calculation.
PTG tells you that too.
Yeah, I was
going to
say.
4 pi is pretty small.
Okay. So this is.
So where I was going for that is. It's very saying, is this going to work in other systems? So that's why I had the caveat, if we understood and you believed the formula for extrapolating, in other cases you might find it doesn't agree with the experiment, and you would infer that those contributions are important.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what is the U in UKIPT? I mean, the
unitarized KIPT?
Yeah. What do you do?
Yeah, as I said, the KIPT is perturbative. So at each order, you only have a finite set of diagrams contributing, for example, to a scattering amplitude. But if you think about the pi-pi scattering, the idea is that you can sum up all the S-channel diagrams, so these type of diagrams. Right, so it's a resummation of all these contributions to all orders, assuming that these are not going to be perturbative contributions to the calculation. So you sum up all these S-channel diagrams, but you leave out everything else perturbative at a given order. And then if you do so, then you get some whole structure, some analytic structure for the scattering amplitude that seems to be agreeing well with experiments. So that's the idea.
What would happen if they resum the UNT channel?
It's just very hard to resum UNT channels, right?
It's just hard.
What?
I'm
still trying to write the paper. So UniTiT is a manifest?
It's a modified version of KIPT, just in an attempt to describe these resonances that are non-perturbative features of meson physics or hadron physics.
It's certainly not on the same level of rigorous.
No, for sure, yes.
Caveat.
All right, I talked about these multiparticle states. So as long as you have in the intermediate states, for example, you have still just the two particle channels. For example, in the rho channel, you could have the pi-pi The KK, for example, right? You could have the two-particle state, but also multi-particle states. So assuming that you don't have enough energy to excite those channels, then you can actually extend very easily, quite easily, the single-channel Luscher to a multiple-channel Luscher. For example, what I've shown here is a two-channel result. And the idea is that, well, you have these correlation functions or some version of a scattering amplitude that you just promote to be a matrix. Then the diagonal part of the matrix are the usual single channel scattering amplitude, and then you have the transition amplitude as the off-diagonal terms of that matrix. Then you can start doing this geometric sum over scattering in two-particle with these two-particle propagators, and then inserting this matrix of kernels. So that's just some promotion to matrix language, which makes this quite easy to drive a modified version of the Luscher when you have the coupled scattering channels. For example, for a two-channel, then you have this form. You still have these delta G functions that would depend on the kinematic of the first channel or the second channel, but then you also have this, for example, the transition amplitudes M21, M12 that you can constrain with this method. So not only you can get, for example, a phase shift for scattering in one single channel, you can get some mixing, the mixing parameter that will characterize the mixing between these two elastic scattering channels. So that's nice. And again, JLab people have used this formalism to practice and look at the pi k, eta k couple channel at 400 MeV. So this system is interesting. You could have three different, for example, angular momentum and parity channels, 0 plus, 1 minus, and 2 plus. So experimentally, it's well known. The resonances, for example, that exist in these channels. So you want to see whether we can constrain those, for example, at these 400 MeV data with this coupled channel formalism. And again, what they do is now they can constrain not only the phase shift in the primary channel, but also the phase shift in the other channel, as well as a mixing parameter for each of these JP channels. And then by looking at, then again, you can parameterize the energy dependence of the phase shift or the transition amplitude in terms of some K matrix that they introduce. And from that, you can analytically continue to the complex plane and start finding, for example, resonances or various states. For example, for this example, they see a broad resonance in the 0 plus channel, but also they see this virtual bound states. So you can identify the first sheet, second sheet, physical and unphysical sheets, again, from this constrained scattering amplitudes or transition amplitudes, and then talk about these sheets. In this channel, for example, you see a narrow resonance. This is a D-wave resonance. And you can also see a very near threshold bound state as well. So this state is known to be a resonance at the physical point, but it's a bound state at these heavy quark masses. So this example also shows that JLab is acquiring the technology to study these states. But you can also see the complexity that they have to deal with. So imagine that you had more than two channels. That would be quite complicated to analyze these data and get all these nice informations. And then if you have multiple particles, more than two, then that's going to be another hard story. I'm going to get to that soon. But instead, this is a very good progress, I would say, happening in the past year or so for these couple channel systems. OK. So what are the other type of observables we're interested in? Obviously, transition amplitudes. So if you're interested in decay rates or some reaction processes in nuclear physics, for example, then it's obvious that we have to understand how to relate these transition amplitudes to what you obtain on the lattice calculations, which is some sort of matrix elements of a given current in a finite volume in Euclidean spacetime. So we saw the nice talk by Norman this morning, which was pointing to the kaon decay to two pions that would require this formalism. So the formalism is due by Lucian Lusher. So we saw a nice practical example that uses this formula to get the amplitude in this channel. There's been other extensions or other derivations and also the extensions of the Lusher. For now, I'm going to focus on a more general form of this derivation, for example, for processes that would be 0 to 2, so you have some sort of current, for example, a gamma ray would go to 2 particle states, or you have 1 particle going to 2 particle states. So you can pick your favorite process, put in here, just insert with a current, and then if you have a 2 particle final states or a couple channel 2 particle final states, how do you relate the this matrix element to the transition amplitudes? You can look at these papers where they work out the most general form of the Lelouch-Lusher type relations, where you can have arbitrary momentum, arbitrary spin. You can have all these partial wave mixing because of the volume effects and so on, and all is encoded in this sort of relation. And it's the way to understand it is that, again, you have to look at the correlation function. Now, instead of just looking at the poles of the correlation functions, you have to look at the full correlation functions, where you actually evaluate the correlation function at the pole, so you end up with a residue of the correlation function at the pole, and then what ends up being on these two sides are the transition amplitudes in the finite volume, in the infinite volume. So these are the objects that you are interested in. On the other side, you have the matrix element that you calculate on the lattice. So if you pick your favorite interpolators, A and B, for a given process, you can have either 0 to 2 or 1 to 2, depending on what you choose for these interpolators. And then you can go ahead and calculate these transition amplitudes from the lattice calculations of matrix elements. So you can reduce these relations, obviously, to the well-known Lelouch-Lusher relations for the K2 pi pi, where this transition amplitude, so this is the physical amplitudes you are after, which is what is evaluated on the lattice, the finite volume piece, the matrix element, times this factor, which will depend on the derivative of the phase shift with respect to energy and some finite volume functions. So that's why you need to constrain these phase shifts as a function of energy very well to be able to take this derivative with good systematics if you're interested in these type of processes. So this is what Norman was referring to today. But you can also look at a more general set of systems and calculate this. So again, JLab has put this into practice and has done this resonant amplitude pi plus to pi plus zero with this gamma. So this amplitude, which is a resonant amplitude because of the raw resonance in this channel. And the nice thing is that you don't have to worry about this. Just for your reference, what you can do is to calculate these matrix elements and use this Lelouch-Lusher type formula to get the transition amplitude. So what you get is some sort of transition amplitude, and you have to parameterize it with some resonance form factor times this function. So you need to know the phase shifts in the pi-pi scattering. You need to know to have constrained the gamma. So we already saw how you can do that as long as you know the delta parameterizations. And then you can constrain basically the form factor, the gamma pi form factor of the rho, which is shown in this plot for several values of the momentum transfer of the photon. And then you can go ahead and calculate the cross-section as well. This is the cross-section for this process, which is showing this nice feature of a resonant around the resonance pole, which is what is expected. This is good. So this was for 0 to 2 and 1 to 2 processes. For 2 to 2 processes, there's been several progress as well on the formal sides and also the calculations. So this is mostly considering the the nuclear physics side of things. So for two nucleon sectors, if you're, for example, interested in a process, the PP fusion process, for example, where you have protons by some weak operators would go to a deuteron state, then how can you relate this matrix on? So this is going to be an ambitious calculations for lattice QCD, but once it's done, then you have to know how to relate that to the physical transition amplitude for this process. This is an important phenomenological process. It's nice to just get it from QCD. So what you are interested in is this transition between, so this is a 3s1, 1s0 transition in the two nucleon system. So it's changing spin. You have this operator between these two nucleon states. So what you're interested in is this transition amplitude to get some sort of cross sections. So as it turned out, you can look at this publication. As it turned out, you can solve this problem. It is a coupled channel problem because it's a 3s1, 1s0, and you can do a coupled channel problem and end up with these relations that would connect the phase shifts of this scattering process as well as this scattering process to the weak matrix, the weak operators in the effective field theory side. So you can write down an effective theory that doesn't include pions. This is a low energy two nucleon effective field theory, pionless EFD. And there is a parameter, the two-body parameters that would characterize a contact interaction that causes the transition between these two channels. And of course, you have the single-body insertions where they can make the transition happen at the loop level too. So you get this relation. So on one side, you have these parameters, L1A and GA. And on the other side, you have the deltas. But then you also have this finite volume function. So it sort of shows you a sort of Lelouch-Loucher formula that would relate the physical infinite volume observables to the infinite volume. So these are evaluated at the at the finite volume energies. You can perturb this relation and get the Lelouch-Loucher looking relation as well. You can look at the paper. A similar result has been also derived by Martin and Will. In the context of introducing a background field. So instead of doing a matrix element calculations, which would be a three-point function or five-point function in this case, you can do just a background field calculation. So for example, for this case, you can introduce an axial background field, and you actually end up with the same formula that would relate, constrain the parameters, that causes this transition in the effective field theory. Another thing is that you can actually introduce a vector background field, a magnetic field, for example, and do this process, which is a neutron and proton produce a gamma and a deuteron. So here, instead of having a neutrino, now you have a gamma in the process, right? So this is something you can do with the background fields, for example. And then if you look at this paper, there is a similar relations that would give you the relation that you need to constrain this L1A, for example, the L1, the corresponding vector two-body current. And in fact, NPRQCD has done the calculations very recently using this formalism, and they've constrained this L1, which, as I said, would be characterized by these sort of two-body current contact interactions at these two different point masses, then you can actually make this extrapolation to the physical point. And if you do that and then get the cross-section based on this formula, so this is just an M1 transition in the using the magnetic field. This is a dominant contribution to this cross-section. And what you need in this M1 transition is L1A. Everything else is basically known from experiment. You can now use this data, put in the L1A, and get some estimate of the cross section. And interestingly, it is in agreement very well with experimental value. So this is very nice. Now you might ask, how do you actually get these values from background field calculations? I'm going to show you some more details. And there's, as I said, what you do is you have a two nucleon systems in either a spin one or a spin zero channel, and you introduce a magnetic field. Then, based on the formula that I just showed you in the previous slide, you can form this difference of the energies, which is basically if you form your correlators, the correlator between the two nucleon systems in S equals 0, S equals 1 channels would have the off-diagonal terms because of this transition amplitude that happens in this magnetic field. Then you need to diagonalize it and then get the energy eigenvalues of that diagonalized correlator so you can form this difference. And then you can see that this energy shift would depend linearly on magnetic field, and the slope of that relation would be L1A. So these are values for the energy as a function of some quantum of the magnetic field. And when you read off the slope, and so this is at different point masses. Then we can end up with these two values for two different point masses of L1A, which is the slope. So this is pretty nice. So as we saw, yeah.
Do you need to use the background field method to get access to that, or could you use this general framework you talked about before?
So this is sort of easier to introduce these background fields. So if you wanted to do the calculations of the matrix elements, then you had to introduce the currents. That would be the usual matrix element calculations with the vector current, which is kind of, more complicated. This background field is kind of simpler to implement this, to get to this. But yes, of course, you could do the alternative calculation to get that. Okay. Can talk about this now, which is the processes that involve more than two hadrons. So you can pick your favorite process. Obviously, many interesting physical systems would include not just one single particle and two particles that we just talked about, but also any number of particles in initial, final, or intermediate states. So how do you consider these systems from a lattice QCD perspective? Do we have the formalism to understand how to relate to physical observables? So, as I said, there are a lot of motivations for considering this problem. Given that we had several talks on the B physics last week, I thought this could be an interesting example of the B decay, the semi-Laplanic decay of B to K star, which is a resonance. So this is a resonance in pi K channel, but you can also think about that the physical point, these are also kinematically allowed. So these are two particle states, and probably more. So if you want to understand that this, if you want to get the transition amplitude from a lattice QCD calculation of matrix elements, then you have to do the same level of rigor to understand the K star final states to make that connection between these observables, okay? And then because you have these multi-particles, then you have to extend the formalism that I just talked about to having more than two particles in these channels. So I'm going to divide these kind of considerations to two parts, a perturbative approach and non-perturbative approaches to this problem. So the perturbative approach is based on the fact that although we are talking about strong interactions, we know that at the hadronic level there are systems that are weakly interacting, like pions and kaons. So in that case, it turns out that the problem of putting n number of, for example, pions in a system, in a finite volume, is just a quantum mechanical perturbation theory problem that you can work out and see what the difference between the energy of the system with and without the interaction is going to be. So it's perturbative calculations. You can do perturbation in powers of 1 over L and the two-body and three-body parameters. So what is done here in these papers that is extended to higher orders later, but again, Real, Martin, and then Shen et al. Is the following. you introduce a two-body, so you introduce an effective Hamiltonian, non-relativistic Hamiltonian that have two-body and three-body contact interactions characterized, for example, for three-body by this eta parameter. And for two-body, you can relate that to the scattering length and effective range of the two-body system. So these are these parameters, these are the volumes and energy shifts. So it seems that now we can use this relation to do some physics about multi-Poisson states and also multi-Kayana states. So NPT solution by using this formula to, first of all, constrain the three pion contact interactions, the three pion interactions, and also the three Kayon interactions. At different pion masses and different volumes, this calculation has been done. And then you can get these values. As soon as you constrain these values, as well as the two-body parameters, you can put back in the energy relation, the energy shift relation. And then, for example, one investigation that you can do now that you have the energy of the system, you can do this multi-particle calculation. So, for example, MPAQCD has gone up to putting 12 pions or 12 kaons in a finite box and look at the energy of the system. And then you can form some sort of chemical potential. And why is that interesting? You can look at the chemical potential as a function of the number density of pions or kaons. And by observing that, for example, this quantity is greater than one, you can say that some sort of pion or kaon condensation can happen at these densities, which is a nice result, given that this is a completely completely QCD calculation that gives this. So this is obviously of great interest if you want to understand what happens in the dense systems of hadrons. So I'm giving you some more references if you're interested in about this multi-pion, kaon, and also nucleon systems in these. But before moving to non-perturbative approaches, I'm going to also show you. So we talked about these matrix dominant and transition amplitudes. For these perturbative systems, for example, you can do, again, a quantum mechanical perturbation theory to relate the matrix elements to this single-body and two-body current injections. Okay. So if you have a generic problem, for example, n pion states, if you can have a transition that is done by this single or two-body currents, then you can go ahead and calculate the matrix element as a function of volume that would depend on this alpha 1, alpha 2, which would characterize the transition in this system. So you can go ahead and do the numerical calculations based on this result that Real and a student has put very recently. Okay, so this for perturbative systems, since that things are under control, what about non-perturbative approaches? So these are of interest, for example, in many areas, especially in nuclear physics, where the forces are not actually strong, the physics is not perturbative. For example, if you're interested in the deuteron breakup in this process, then you have to have a perturbative calculation that will relate the correlation function of this system on the lattice on upcoming lattice QCD calculations to the Breakup rate, for example, for this process from a physical point. I'm going to mention two different approaches to this problem. So one is what Raoul and I did several years ago by using a dimer particle formalism to study the system and see whether or not we can find a Luescher-like relations for these three particle systems. And the idea is based on, again, forming these correlation functions, but reducing, sort of simplifying the problem by introducing this dimer field, which includes all the two-body interactions non-perturbatively in it. So this is effectively a 2 plus 1 system. Then you can form this chain of diagrams when you have this three-body strong interaction kernel. The kernel is now kind of more complicated because you have this type of exchange diagrams. These exchange diagrams would not allow you to separate out these loops in terms of momentum modes, and that's why it makes the problem quite hard. And What you end up with is a simple-looking relation, but however, it's not that simple, because what ends up being here is not the actual scattering amplitude in the three-body system that you're after. It's a scattering amplitude of a finite volume dimer with the particle through this infinite volume loops, and then you have some sort of finite volume functions. So, and then also this relation is not an algebraic relation, it's a summation, because you cannot separate out these loops, as I said. However, it's just a formal form. It hasn't been used in practice, and we sort of haven't done many more explorations of what we can do with this. What I'm going to mention is that just this relation has a sort of a coupled channel characteristics. When you have different channels in a finite volume, you could have a bounded state, you could have a two-body bounded state, a scattering of one particle, you can have several other scattering three-body particle states. So whatever your energy is, then you could have several of these states available, and you have to put this and do a couple channel analysis of this system. But anyway, there's been another approach in a special limit when there is the two particle states in the unitary limit. You can get an energy shift that is exponential in volume done by these physicists. It's interesting to see how these relations, which has derived with a different method, whether or not so you can get that from this complicated relations that is here. Another investigations or the calculations done in this area is by looking at the three-party correlation function. So instead of introducing the dimer, if you just look at the three particles and just try to form all sorts of different type of contributions to this three-particle correlation functions, you end up with this skeleton expansion that is done here. So this is the work done by Steve Sharp and Max Hansen, and it's kind of ongoing, process to understand and generalize this formalism. I'm not going to go into the technicalities. Again, you get a simple-looking relation, a finite volume function F, and some K matrix, divergence-free K matrix, that they have been able to show that how this K matrix is related to the actual physical 3-2-3 scattering amplitude. Again, this is a complicated relation. Seems hard to do calculation in practice, but it's going to be more work to generalize it also to more general set of systems when you have resonances, bounded states, and so on. But this is an ongoing process. So as you can see, the three-body physics is not at the same level of maturity yet as the two-body physics. But given the importance of understanding these formalism to get a variety of physics, it makes sense to push this farther and farther. Okay. How much time do I have?
Just keep going.
Okay.
So
yes, I have one section left, and this is QED section. So because there's been some interest in QED topic, I thought I would just say a few words on this topic as well, and then I just finish. I try to go quickly over this. If you have any questions or you want to discuss more, just feel free to just stop by and talk. Okay, so now that we have all these different observables, and given that a lot of calculations, well, several calculations are entering the precision area, then it's important to include the QED effects, okay? And but QED somehow is special compared to QCD because you have these infinite range interactions. The photon is massless, so what do we deal with this large volume effects? So a way to understand why QED is actually special is just from a classical point of view. If you just put a charged particle inside this cubic volume and impose periodic boundary conditions, then immediately you can see that you cannot satisfy the Gauss's law and also the Ampere's law. So the classical equation of motions seem to not be holding when you have this system with periodic boundary conditions, which actually comes, you can show that it comes from the zero mode of the photon is responsible for this classical equations. So what do we do? A way to fix a problem, to have finite volume calculations, for example, with periodic boundary conditions, but are still not violating the Gauss's law, to be able to enclose a charge inside a volume, is the following. You can introduce a constant uniform background charge to the system. And the way to do it is just couple this charge density to a new field, and then make sure that, for example, the B0 component, when integrated over a space, would give the electric charge that is the negative of that of the charge enclosed. So as a whole, the system does not have any charge, but at any given spatial point, you haven't done anything, right? Because this is at the level, as you take the infinite volume limit, there's basically, you haven't done anything by introducing this charge density. And how do we implement this in the lattice calculations? It's easy to know how to do this, because you can take a variation of action with respect to this being your field, and what you end up is this relation. And in order to satisfy this relation, you can see that you have several choices, but you can make this choice where you put the zero three momentum vector of the ANU field equal to zero. So remove the zero mode of the photon, and that would give you the prescription. It's the prescription that would make sure that you have a consistent QED in a finite volume with periodic boundary conditions. So this is the basis of many of these calculations that include QED along with QCD calculations. There's been an alternative choice that has been investigated in this paper quite recently, like last week, where in order to deal with the infrared effects in this QED calculations, you can actually give a mass to the photon and then do some sort of extrapolation to the zero mass limit at the end and see whether or not that's preferable to the usual removal of the zero mode. But a little bit, yes. Okay. All right, so what do we want to include QED effects on the masses? This is a nice example by the BMW collaboration. I'm sure everybody is aware of this calculation. Basically, you can not only post-stick the mass splittings between isospin multiplets, you can also make predictions for these mass splittings that are not known experimentally, like these values, or make more precise determinations where the experiments aren't that precise. Okay, so these calculations have done a dynamical QCD and QED calculation at physical values of quark masses, so this is quite impressive progress. Given that you have dynamical QED, you might ask how you control the finite volume effects and get such precise numbers. So,
I don't think they actually did the calculation of physical quark masses, did they? So they extrapolated.
And they're very close to the physical point.
Like 250 MeV pi.
No, they have.
It's not physical.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to just say a few words of how you estimate these finite volume effects. There's been different approaches to get these volume effects. I'm going to focus on a method that we are describing in this paper with Martin. And the idea is quite simple, starting from a classical system. So if you have a charge sphere inside a volume and you introduce this constant charge, or alternatively you can say the removal of the zero mode, and you have periodic boundary condition, you might ask what's the self-energy in the system, the self-energy of this charged sphere. You can go ahead and do the calculation for the self-energy, and then assuming that the characteristic scale of this system, the R, is small compared to L, you can make an expansion in 1 over L, so these are power law expansion that you would expect in this electrostatic problem. And then you can identify this term, which is the familiar self-energy of the charged sphere. But then also at the next, the leading volume correction, which is 1 over L, seems to not depend at all on the structure of this object, or R. So you might think that if you think about the low energy effective theory, this could be an infinite mass limit of a corresponding low energy theory, where this term would not depend on the details of the the system, basically. And then if you look at this next term, one of our L cubed, you can rewrite it in such a way that identify this term as a coefficient of the charge radius of the particle. So if you think about the particle equivalence of this system, you would think about the low energy theory that does an expansion in the mass of the particle, but also, so this is the heavy field, effective field theory, basically, but also in compositeness scale of the problem. For example, if you have a charge radius or polarizability in a system, you would expand in those couplings, non-minimal couplings to QED as well. And you can write down, so this is a very well-known Lagrangian non-relativistic QED modified in such a way to have a structure of the particles. And then, so when you have this, and the idea is the following. So why are we looking at this low energy effective field theory? We are interested in getting the IR correction to the system, right? And when this is an IR physics, you don't have to worry about much about the short distance details of the theory that describes your particles. As long as you have this consistent low energy theory, you can study the IR effects in the theory. So you can go ahead and calculate the self-energy of the particle with these various interactions perturbatively in 1 over L. This is what you're interested in. I'm just showing you several diagrams. You don't have to stare at it too much. It's just telling you that you can systematically go ahead and insert all these operators, minimal and non-minimal couplings, to get the self-energy at order alpha E in QD coupling. So this is the leading order. Obviously, we're not interested in alpha E squared. It's very small. But when you do that, then you can get these values for leading order, next to leading order, and so on. And as you can see, the leading order, as I said, is exactly what you get for the self-energy of a charged sphere in classical physics. That's what we expected. You have this next to leading order. And then, as I said, you get these corrections that if you have good memory to remember that the charged sphere results, that's exactly what we got there. So it's quite consistent. But then also you get these corrections at the higher order that would depend on the structure of the particle as well.
So this phi is some composite particle.
This is a scalar composite field that interacts with.
So it's minus radius.
Yes. Right. So this is a charge radius of the scalar. This is the mass of the scalar. You have the polarizabilities, electric and magnetic, and then so on. You can go to all higher orders as you want, but as I will show, these are quite a small corrections, at least for the physical point.
Is there a similar formula for the nucleon?
Yes. We have worked it out in the paper. I'm not going to show it here, but it's all in the paper. And these two corrections are actually universal. As you can see, they don't depend on the structure. They also don't depend on the spin. So these are coming from non-minimal coupling.
So
the minimal coupling.
I have a specific question about protons. So in this so-called proton radius crisis, where old-fashioned determinations of the constant when you get from monocotrygens seem to disagree by a lot, there's a quantity there. I think it's called the Zebach moment, which is something like there's like R cubed of the nucleon. And I think that's just estimated with hand wave. So would there be a term like this in your formula for the protons, or you could actually calculate that object?
I don't know about that quantity, but one thing that we thought was that whether you can, from the finite volume of corrections to the system, whether you can actually constrain, for example, the charge radius, right? So you do the calculation.
This would be a higher moment beyond the charge radius.
Right. So I'm guessing that
this special to the three-bond system.
I don't know about that.
I'm trying to find out more about it.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, but if you want to, for example, constrain this charge radius from this effects, it seems to be hard. I mean, these corrections are going to be very small, as we will see, so it's probably not a good way to do it. I'm going to mention that there's been considerations of this problem with different approaches, carrier perturbation theory, and also by BMW people, just looking at the usual QED self-energy diagrams. There isn't a slight discrepancy between our results and theirs. We're still investigating this, but at least for this scalar theory and at this order, everything seems to agree. They don't have the structure corrections in this form, the explicit form that we have here. But anyway, so you can, based on the formula that I showed you, you can go ahead and see what the expected QED final volume corrections would be at the physical point. So if you input the physical, for example, pion mass and charge radius and polarizabilities and so on, and then see what, get some estimate of these volume corrections to the mass, then you end up with these curves. Right? So for charged pions, there seems to be at 4 Fermi some not large deviation from, so this is the charge squared, the pion mass squared. So it's below Pearson level at the end of the day, but also for the neutral pion, it's quite small, as you can see. It's at the level of KeV. And the reason is that they don't have charge. So as we saw, the leading contributions are universal and coming from the charge of the particle, not the structure. So these are going to be 1 over L cubed and are very small, at least for the physical pions. As I said, we've looked at the nucleon case too. So this is for proton and neutron. And again, you see that for Fermi, the correction to the mass of the proton is quite small. It's like minus 0.5. But if you think about the mass difference, then you're going to worry about these corrections as BMW did for a precision calculation. And for the neutron, this is going to be a small, again, at the level of KV, doesn't have a charge. Okay. Maybe I just say a few words, just 2 minutes on this slide, although this is important progress also. So Martin and Silas Bean at the University of Washington also looked at the elastic scattering of charged particles. And this problem is particular because at low energies, this set of diagrams that describe the charged particles are not actually perturbative. At low energy, just there is an enhancement. And you cannot ignore this coupled exchange diagrams. You have to sum them up, as is well known from infinite volume physics. So, for example, proton-proton scattering is well known. And you can see that the perturbative expansion comes with this parameter, and at low energies, this blows up. One nice feature that you can, about the finite volume physics that Martin and Silas noticed, is that. I'm not going to talk about these diagrams so anymore. And one nice feature of finite volume with periodic boundary condition is that you have these discrete momentum modes. And then if you remove the zero mode of the photon, the next mode is going to be like 1 over L. So the lowest energy in the system, so if you think about the scattering cuts, so this is the inelastic cut, and this is the T-channel cut. If you think about these cuts, if you didn't remove the zero mode, like in the infinite volume, these cuts would start at zero. And that means that you have to deal with this non-perturbative problem. However, when you remove the zero mode in the finite volume, you would basically shift the start of these cuts by of the order of 1 over L or square root of 1 over L. So that gives you a window that you can do perturbative calculation in this problem. And by perturbative, that means that you only keep only one of these photon exchanges, and that would be enough to give the leading corrections to the looser type formula that you can write down. So that would be the condition that you have to satisfy in order for this parameter to be a small. So that gives you a range of valid volumes for this treatment.
Sorry, may I just stop you for a moment? Yeah. So if you said that this gap is proportional to 1 over L. So this means that it gets worse and worse if you go to larger volumes.
That's true. That's true. So that's why I said that there is just a window. So you have to make sure that you just satisfy this relation. So as long as you do that, you're fine. But yes, in the infinite volume, then the problem is just because you have to worry about the lowest mode, which would be proportional to 1 over L. So there is an optimal volume here to have this perturbative consideration. And then this is the result. I guess I don't talk much about that, but it's basically a corresponding Luscher formula when you have the corrections of the order of alpha e. You can read the paper to see what these parameters. So these are basically scattering an effective range at the modified kinematic of the system. And this is a new finite volume function. So you have double sums and so on. Obviously, you can think about extending this formalism to non-perturbative systems if you want. Would be very hard. Also, this is just an S-wave result. You might think about extending straightforwardly to other channels. Then I'm going to mention just further applications toward precision calculation in hadronic physics. We had several talks, so like the mu and g minus 2, then you have dynamical QED in Tom's talk, or tomorrow, as we hear from Chris's talk, then you can include the QED to study these pion, for example, the leptonic decay constants. And if you want to introduce QED, you have to understand the finite volume effect. So you have to worry about these type of diagrams at the hadronic level. Also for K to pi pi amplitude, if you're ambitious enough to include QED, then for example, you have these exchange diagrams that has to be included in the two pion states, but also this single particle correction. So these are several applications you can think of extending when necessary. Okay, I'm just gonna finish by just saying that this this is the last slide. Multi-hadron amplitudes and matrix elements are being constrained with lattice QCD. And as I mentioned, this is important in understanding the spectrum of QCD and exotics and also hadronic interactions, but also in testing fundamental symmetries of nature and the test and search for new physics in these kind of experiments when you have, for example, the direct detection experiments for dark matter or neutrino experiments, you need to understand the hadronic level matrix elements. So this is treating QCD as a background, it's then important to understand this multi-hadron matrix element, for example, and constrain them very well in order to make any predictions for physics beyond the standard model. Okay, thanks very much, and I'm very sorry for running out of time.
Thank you, Sarah, for this exhaustive. Are there any more questions?
So in K to pi pi with the photon, do you have the same problem that becomes a non-perturbative problem with the photon?
It depends on the volume, right?
So it'll be, but it's the same issue?
Yes.
Anything else? Yeah. So some experiments are studying the complicated mode of the BDK. JPSI,
PSI, and KL,
is this something that you
have
a chance to study in the future?
Sure, right. So one thing you can think of, whenever you have non-local matrix elements, like one example would be K long, K short, then you have to think about these intermediate states when you insert two non-local, two operators in this manner. So one thing that, for example, I showed a slide on BDK, for example, to get started. Then around the JPSI pole, you have to understand the resonant formalism for including those. But I would say it still requires more work in that direction. But yes, I think.
Right. Something that could be studied numerically?
I hope so. Well, not at the moment. We don't have enough technology, but yes, eventually, I think it seems that we have now enough experience with understanding these finite volume systems to go to more complicated systems.
So with these QED corrections in the paper, you estimated also for D minus 2, but for the Schwinger term.
Yes.
Can you do it for individual contributions with the same approach? Like the hadronic bubble polarization, for example?
You could do that. We haven't done that. So we showed that for the Schwinger term, you get a very large corrections that has been actually also shown in G minus 2 dynamical photons to scale that way. But no, we haven't. As I said, that could be one application. to understand how different methods of G-2 has been done with different methods to, they would have essentially different. So if you do a subtraction, for example, it's possible that you cancel off some of these minor volume effects, but no, we haven't done much investigation.
Should that, would it? It would be nice to see it.
Okay.
See anyone else jumping up and down, so let's thank our